Hello and welcome to this week's VFX show number 83. This week, we're joking before the show started that it should be episode number 77 because we're jumping back to look at Star Wars. I like to think of it as episode one. You'll know it as episode four, New Hope. And I'm joined on the line by Mark. How are you, Mark?
Doing great, Mike. Thank you.
Mark Christensen is sitting somewhere, I believe, in San Francisco. Is that right?
Yes, adjacent to Union Square in my office here.
Excellent. And also by our good friend David Strapinis, who's still in LA, I believe.
That I am.
Excellent, excellent. Well, gentlemen, we have a delightful show ahead of us this week. We get to look at the visual effects of Star Wars. Now, in doing this, we've strictly limited ourselves to discussing the visual effects of Star Wars Episode 4. And we will do another episode in coming weeks where we're going to discuss Star Wars and some of the things to do with the franchise, the games, the Star Tours rides, a bunch of other stuff that goes off topic. But this week we're going to try and stick as close as we can just to this one pivotal moment in cinema history when young boys like myself sat in the third row from the front and watched a spaceship come over our heads and said, hey, I want to go and do that. That looks like fun in terms of visual effects. Was that the experience for either of you two guys?
Well, you know, this show was actually my idea because, as is no secret, we often go back and do older movies. And I realized, I think like 2 months ago, I was like, have we ever done Star Wars? And we were all kind of surprised to realize we hadn't because you can't think of a film that's more important to visual effects than Star Wars, in my opinion. While Star Wars itself is obviously incredibly important, we'll stick to that one tonight. It wasn't so much Star Wars that got me interested in being in visual effects as it was Return of the Jedi. And in particular, there's a making-of special that was on CBS that I had to do extra chores for 2 weeks in order to stay up and see. Because that was the first time I realized that there were people who made movies. Like, you know, I was young, so, like, I'd never realized that there was a job involved in making movies. I saw my dad getting up early and putting on a tie and going to an office and then coming home. And then I saw the special and there's people who, you know, play with toys and fire and monster costumes and stuff. And I was like, that's what I have to do for a living. And that was really the seminal moment for me.
What about you, Mark?
It was certainly the biggest movie experience that I had. I came out of the movie, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was so inspired, but I sort of was at a loss. I thought, well, I guess I have to join the Air Force if I actually want to do that in real life. So it wasn't so much that I got fascinated with the process of doing it then. What's interesting is that the magic didn't really fade. And later on, when I had the opportunity to work first at ILM and then really to start my career in earnest at LucasArts, I was thrilled to work for George and to work on these stories and this whole world.
I think we need to put it in a little bit of perspective because we now think of Star Wars as being linked to ILM, but Star Wars preceded ILM and it was the reason for ILM's existence. And to put that in some perspective, we just have to look at the summer blockbusters that happened this summer in the US. And we look at, say, Harry Potter, Transformers, Terminator Salvation, and Star Trek. These are all ILM films. All ILM films that, you know, good or bad in terms of plot, are magnificent visual effects pieces. Not one of those films is failing to deliver on high-end visual effects. And yet, when Star Wars was conceived, it was a temporary unit put together to do the visual effects, literally because Fox's effects unit itself had shut down and there was no comparable ILM, there was no industry, there was just literally none of the visual effects that we now take for granted. To look at Star Wars and to frame it back to today is really to look at the entire history of visual effects, and we'll pick up on some of those elements next week. But David, maybe you can give us a quick sort of snapshot of the technology that was available to the team that assembled as sort of a pre-ILM Star Wars effects unit to do the special effects for this film, because it is almost inconceivable what they didn't have to work with.
They had bupkis, really. Everything that we really do take for granted and just think of as second nature was either cutting edge technology at the time or what had to be invented for the movie. You know, you had even something as simple as blue screen. was a complicated chemical photographic process, not a let's put it into the computer and select a color and that gets keyed out. You had, you know, even the concept of dailies or being able to, you know, in a computer these days, you have like a play blast that you do to check your motion. That was impossible. You had to do your shot and almost have it on faith that you did it right, because you would have to go through and expose your entire, you know, you do your pass on your ship, and then you do your pass, a second pass on a second ship, and you do a really quick develop on them and slap them together and run them through Moviola and see if it looked good. And, you know, this is not a simple process. So in order to do something like a, you know, 3-second shot of four ships flying by the camera, that's a 3-, 4-, 5-, 6-day process just to get the elements that you need, never mind to, you know, start compositing them to a finished quality and all that kind of stuff. Motion control cameras were rudimentary at best. The way of programming them was quite complicated and very, very technical. This isn't like you sit there and you program in your move. It's like, no, you sit down and you build a circuit board that by hand, and this controls your stuff. This is real hardcore nerd movie making, and you know, it was the Industrial Light and Magic is like the perfect combination of words for the people, because it was, you know, industrial meaning you building stuff with your hands, light obviously because they're doing all sorts of photographic stuff, and magic because it really was magic that these people came together to create this. Because you look, you know, you think of legends of our field these days, Dennis Muren, Ken Ralston, these were, you know, the B operators on the film.
Absolutely. And there's just no doubt that when these guys were working on doing this, there was a real sense that they had to invent as they went along, because it just didn't exist. There just was nothing there that produced what they needed to do. And so that invention, I think, also is seen in the shots themselves, because there are shots, and I'm going to start with the most obvious, which is the opening scrolling text sequence. And Mark, I'm sure you'll remember this, that when that sequence came along, the idea of how they did it was quite elusive to many of us.
Yeah. Yes, it was. That was one of many things, even near the beginning of the film, that we'd never seen before.
And I mean, tell us how they actually did do that. I mean, most people will probably know the story, but just run us through it.
Well, literally, a sign with a camera running along a track, filming it.
Yeah, they literally laid the text down on the floor of the studio, and then kind of ran a camera down above it, as it were, looking down,
exactly.
Which of course creates the impression that it's scrolling away. And I can remember even a year or two after that, being talking to character generator people who were making electronic character generators that were obviously the first simple computer graphics-y kind of things that most of us got our hands on. And it was always the thing when somebody had a new character generator and they were like really clever. So you can't make text go up in perspective, can you, like Star Wars? It was like, no, that's too hard. We can make it scroll up. We can make it get it smaller. Can't make it move back in perspective. And I guess for me, that's sort of quintessentially Star Wars. When somebody tells you how they did it, you go, well, of course, obviously. But when you're sitting there in the cinema,
kind of an easy way, right?
Oh, yeah. It just looked magnificent. So I'm going to ask you guys, because I think it's a fait accompli, perhaps it isn't. For me, there is no greater shot in the first Star Wars film than the opening sequence where the ships come in from overhead. For me, that was everything that got me from the first few minutes of the film. I was stunned at how magnificent that was and almost couldn't believe that no one had ever done anything like that before. What about you, David?
Very, very important shot, but my actual favorite shot in the entire movie is it's a shot of the Death Star. Like, there's two dudes standing there manning a gun, and the Millennium Falcon is just being sucked into the landing bay by the tractor beam, and it's this little tiny ship against this vast, you know, gray monolithic face. And it was like, you know, now I look at it and it's so simple that it's like, okay, you have humans inside the ship, and then you have this ship tiny against this big monolith, and it sets the size of the Death Star. But, you know, to my 7-year-old mind, I was like, that thing is so huge. You know, it's just, you know, the quality of that shot. And then it cuts to this beautiful, you know, mix of a live action set, visual effects of the Millennium Falcon settling, and matte painting as it's landing, and all the stormtroopers are forming up. That those two shots together, I just thought were brilliant.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that second shot with the matte painting, when I discovered that was a matte painting, I was just knocked off my feet. I was like, I had no idea how they did it. When I discovered that somebody just painted that, I couldn't believe that you could paint that well, that you couldn't tell the difference between where the live action stopped and started. And then I went and researched it more, and then there was the shot with Obi-Wan Kenobi coming around the back of to turn off the tractor beam. And again, same thing, small live action played into a huge glass painting. I just couldn't believe that someone could be that good with their artistry that they would manage to pull that off.
And again, people have to remember, this is not, you know, someone opening up a copy of Photoshop or Painter or what have you and painting something and then tweaking it and copying and pasting and whatever. This is a piece of glass that someone painted on from reverse so that every single thing had to be right. You know, when you touched your brush to the glass, it was right. Or you got out the razor blade and you cleaned it off and you started from scratch again. The craftsmanship that is in every single visual effect shot in this film is amazing.
I mean, it was such a significant jump. There were really good visual effects film. Like 2001 is a really good, it's not like the only visual effects film from that period that it was good, but it was, as you say, the artistry in almost every single shot, attention to detail. But Mark, let's hear your favorite shot, because we've heard both David's and mine.
Favorite shot. I think the initial descent into the trench is a pretty damn cool shot. And it has this kinetic energy to it that when I went and learned how they did it and how it even reflects the personality of the person who programmed it, which I think in that case may have been Dennis Muren, I'm pretty blown away. The way that those motion control cameras were programmed was one vector at a time, one direction at a time. And as you say, computers were just beyond punch cards at this point. The Homebrew Computer Club had just that year started in my hometown of Menlo Park, and really computers just couldn't do anything.
The really amazing thing about how the trench shots were programmed is they couldn't even get, you know, they couldn't have an eyepiece on the camera when it was traveling down the trench, so they couldn't tell if they were getting it right. So they put electric guitar pickups in the set and the corresponding part on the camera, and they didn't even program it optically. They programmed it by listening to the stepper motors and the tone they produced in how close they were to the walls of the trench, and they programmed it literally by ear, not by eye, because they would listen to how it did, and then they'd run it and they'd develop it and take a look and would be able to correspond the movement of the camera to the sound it made when they programmed it. And you think about that and you just consider how easy that kind of stuff is today, and you're just blown away by it.
I mean, the very cameras that they were using on this were, in many cases, 1950s VistaVision cameras, because the whole idea of high-end special effects, you know, cameras just didn't exist, and they wanted obviously a larger plate, which they could get by running the film horizontally, not vertically. And so they weren't even sort of using the latest technology of a period which didn't have very, you know, sort of high-tech technology by today's standards. They were using 1950s cameras. Now, that may seem like a trivial point, but you've got to think about it in terms of image stability, because at the same time they're trying to composite these things, they needed these things to be locks steady, and they could not have drift and float. And so there was a physical engineering milling side of all of this that has almost gone by the wayside. You know, the famous ability of ILM just to make their own cameras, because they just had such a precision craftsman. And yet all of this was still in a temporary setup, because we weren't ILM yet. We were just the company that would sort of reform for the second film as ILM. And I mean, I know that a large percentage of the budget went on, you know, doing some shots, and there's like folklore about whether or not those shots were used and stuff. But for me, it's not even that. It's the artistry that you guys touched on that I think is phenomenal. And I think I want to discuss this because it's one of the, you know, pivotal things that you need to teach a young animator or designer is the use of reference. And why so many of these shots seem to resonate so well is because they did have such excellent reference. So that dogfight sequence going in to the canal to shoot down the Death Star was a reference to, you know, the Dam Busters sequence, and they did cut together a whole lot of Second World War flying footage. But there are many occasions throughout the film where the film just resonates with truth because they decided to pick up on something that we know and then translate it into the future. Wouldn't you agree with that, Mark? I mean, it just has this kind of believability to it.
Yeah. First of all, the use of the Dam Busters footage when George was pre-planning the movie is in many ways the first example of pre-visualization for visual effects. And it was for a specific reason. He wasn't interested, like Kubrick, in being scientifically accurate about the behavior of spaceships in space. And instead, he wanted this kinetic energy to the ships, which meant that they would have yaw and they would have these characteristics of planes. And even George calls them planes. He doesn't call them ships. And so he, you know, it was true on the new movies too. He'd talk about what the plane does. And there was an energy to, you know, the 10 hours of footage that he cut down to his 20-minute final that they were forced to recreate in those sequences.
Yeah.
And they did it by having, you know, they have these, you know, spaceships that are built in a way that you would never build an actual spaceship to look like that.
Yeah, because it doesn't need to be aerodynamic.
It doesn't need to be, you know, you can have a cube in space and it works just the same, which Star Trek later went on to do. But you also, you know, they had the ships traveling at relatively, you know, what would be very slow speed of 40, 50 miles an hour, and then they jump to light speed. And by having them, you know, you get that kind of drifting around of, you know, in the sights and then out of the sights and barely missing and flying right over the Millennium Falcon, and it has that energy. And you look at even, you know, not even a space dogfight, but you look at something like Top Gun, which is incredibly boring. Not incredibly boring, but, you know, you have two ships that are, you know, they're 2 miles away from each other, and then they rocket past each other, and then they're 2 miles away from each other in the opposite direction. And then they fire a missile, and then one of them blows up. But that's not what he wanted. You know, he wanted that War One biplane feeling that I think owes a lot to the Howard Hughes film Hell's Angels.
I think it does owe a lot to Hell's Angels. That's a very good reference. I think the other one, we've mentioned the Dam Busters, but actually 633 Squadron, the 1964 film directed by some German, I said Walter Goodman. Anyway, that is another really, if you get that film out, which is almost impossible to find, or you can find it on online, then that dogfight sequence in that is very similar. But you know, the principle of that is, I think you said, Mark, this idea of pre-vising by referencing, you know, other pieces of footage. Again, totally take it for granted today. But I think it works at so many places throughout the film. There's just, you know, a feeling like that the cantina, or pick anywhere basically, they feel real because, you know, you've almost seen that before. Whether you're aware of references to really cool Japanese Kurosawa kind of films or not, they're, you know, when you're in that sort of cantina environment, there's a lot of Wild Westy kind of ripped off from Japanese samurai film type vibe. Yeah. And it happens again and again and again throughout the whole film.
Yeah, and the on the actual models, I think, you know, much like when we discussed way back when on the Blade Runner show, where a lot of people today, they look at Blade Runner and don't realize how revolutionary it was that to have that the look designed by Sid Mead. You know, the fact that this was a used universe that felt like people lived in it, that everything wasn't all shiny and new and everything like that, was revolutionary in and of itself, to the point where when Fox executives were looking at the models, they thought that they just had a team of really crappy model makers on their hand who couldn't make a decent-looking spaceship. You know, that all this stuff looked broken down and used. And that was the whole point. You know, nowadays everybody knows that you have to add grime and, you know, streaks and dirt in the crevices and all that in order to make it feel real. Well, the reason you know that is because these guys figure that out.
Apparently there was on set, the floors, I think, I'm going to say right this in the Death Star, that somebody, I think I'm right in saying this, were kept on cleaning them, and they would like deliberately scuff them in the morning, and then someone had sort of come through and sort of clean everything up, and they'd sort of come back and go, hang on a second, we spent a lot of time scuffing these up, and now they're looking really good. And they go, yep, ready to film. Because the whole idea of having a lived-in universe, you're absolutely right. Like, I mean, it was just, they just nailed that start of that look. And I mean, 2001 was what, 68? So it was like a bit before this. And that view of the future was the sort of ultra clean sci-fi. I mean, it's a gorgeous film. There's nothing, take nothing away from 2001, but it really was sort of an extension of the sense of that Apollo program, clean, weightless kind of thing. There was almost no weightlessness in this film, which is kind of an interesting thing given how much sort of space stuff was going on.
Yeah, it's not useful. It's like the way the planes move instead of moving like ships. It's just not what's called for.
Yeah, and so we've discussed things that we really like about the film. I wanted, is there anything that you feel like, given the context of the... Oh, sorry, go on.
When you mentioned 2001, it got me thinking, because 2001 was done by Doug Trumbull, you know, and after 2001, he had set up his own facility. I forget what the name of that was, but... he was originally approached to do the visual effects for Star Wars, and he turned it down. And I just can't help but think, and so, you know, so they went to, you know, his assistant, his camera assistant, John Dykstra, to see if he wanted to do it, and he did, and went off and formed, you know, what became ILM. And I just have to think how different history would have been if Doug Trumbull had done that. You know, you wouldn't have had to bring together all these crazy people who had never really worked in visual effects before, because not many people had. And you know, just that one little decision, you know, completely changed everything.
Yeah, well, of course, Dykstra was part of the Oscar-winning team. I think there were about five people that won the Oscar that year for in 1977 for Star Wars. And deservedly so. Like, I mean, in fact, I think Star Wars is the only film that was nominated for an Oscar for Best Picture out of all of the six of the Star Wars films. What I was going to ask you about, though, is in terms of when you saw the film, almost not with the, you know, cold, harsh reality of looking back with all the experience that you have, was there anything that kind of took you out of the film? Because I have one thing that I saw when watching it that took me out of the film, and to this day I laugh when I see it. Is there anything that you guys sort of remember in the film as being incongruous or just popped out at you?
I love the moment where the stormtrooper bangs his head on the set and they actually added a sound effect for it.
That's in the opening when they're storming the ship, right?
No, it's later in the film, but it's,
oh, is it? Okay.
It's pretty funny. Yeah.
The only thing that as a kid I ever you know, saw that was like a little bit lame, if that I didn't fully buy, was the cantina makeup. I always thought that was a little bit like less than stellar, but you know, knowing what I know now and looking back, I understand why it was, but it to me always seemed like very cheap compared to the rest of the film. That and the garbage alien, I always thought was a little bit weird looking, but
that was the very last thing added to the film.
Was it? Was it really?
Yeah, I think it was the very last effects shot.
Really? Huh. I didn't know that.
The last edition, the last thing started and finished, I think, yeah. Other than some absolute drop-dead roto that apparently somebody killed themselves for.
Because apparently Mark Hamill had a car accident and they was really limited on what they could do and go back and reshoot and stuff.
Yeah, that's why the approach is all behind him.
Right. I've got to say, for me, the only thing which I still to this day laugh at is when they're activating the Death Star and they hit a Grass Valley 300 switcher. Because I was such a geek that even then I was like, hang on a second, I've seen one of those before. What's that thing? I may not be able to give you the serial number, but I kind of knew it was a TV thing. And And clearly, you know, if you had to build a device that had a big button or a T-bar that lets you activate it, that if you had one of those lying around, it was a good idea for the art department to use it. But it's funny because, you know, it was like, well, there's, hang on a second, what's that doing in Star Wars universe as opposed to anything else? And I think it was probably the greatest product placement that no one ever paid for, because anyone in the industry knew what that was.
I have a different idea than asking what would you fault about the film. What about among the things that were changed for the special edition, which one seemed to make the most sense to actually do?
The most sense?
I'm not actually convinced that I needed any of them.
I think the most sense for me, and the thing that I appreciated the most, well, let me just say this. When I was in the cinema, I think one of the greatest things they ever did was the trailer that you may have seen at the cinema, which started with a rectangle on the screen and had sort of mono sound almost, and said, for an entire generation, they'd only ever watched Star Wars like this. And then X-Wing fighter comes at the screen, which is a box, and breaks that out, and then the whole screen widens out to scope, and then the sound goes from what seemed like mono to surround sound, and it goes, you know, re-releasing now, you can experience it again as it was intended to be. And I remember seeing that and just going, oh my God, I so want to see this.
Well, that restoration is some of the best stuff. I mean, the expansion of the battle approach, great, and you know, I think some of the more seamless stuff like that works really well.
So those X-Wing shots where they managed to do more kind of spinning around and flying around, mm-hmm. I definitely thought that no longer felt like it was restricted quite as much as I was then, you know, no longer accustomed to seeing, as we'd seen from the motion controllers, because the motion controllers just couldn't pull off some of those moves that that happened.
Personally was really impressed also by the added Mos Eisley footage, the big shot over the city. That was a very difficult shot to pull off at the time. I know when George said he wanted to move the camera up 2 more feet, Yusei Wesky, who was the matte painter on that, just about fell over because it was going to add something like 8 months to reveal that much of the city. And they pretty much pulled it.
Knowing now that we did that the underneath of the what was the hover thing that they were on? I should know the name of that.
Land speeder
was done with a mirror. When I watched it originally, I was dumbfounded as to how they did that. Once I knew it was a mirror, I could see it. So obviously in the re-release, that was fixed up so that it no longer could be picked if you knew what to look for.
Yeah. That kind of bothered me, because I always thought that the weird look underneath it was whatever effect was holding it off the ground.
Right.
You know, I love to look at the, to me, now keep in mind that when the re-releases came out, me and my best friend in college, Cullen, we went and we saw every single showing on the first day. We saw the re-release 7 times on opening day. That's how big of a Star Wars fan I was. Now, looking back in retrospect, I really wish they had only fixed the sound, you know, to bring the sound up to kind of a modern mix, and gotten rid of the garbage mats around the ships. That was the only thing I thought, like, okay, you know, do the restoration and fix those black levels and all that kind of stuff. But other than that, just leave it alone. It didn't need to be touched. Yeah, I understand that he feels that they're incomplete, but they were as they were, and leave it alone.
I think the restoration was important, given how much of the footage was shot on a stock that was degrading, and how the blacks had milked up, and, you know, we really had lost a really high quality copy of the film. So I definitely think the restoration was valid. Whether or not they needed to do those effect shots, I guess the one that I didn't like is, and I'm not going to say who shot first, it's actually when Han is walking around the back of you know, in the hangar, the added scene.
That is an awful, awful shot.
Yeah, and he steps up on the tail, and I just didn't believe that the actor had done that. It just looked like a DVE move, and I was kind of mortified. By the way, as we've been talking, my producer has handed me a note claiming that it was actually a 16 4K television production switcher, not a Grass Valley 300 switcher, as I just said. But anyway, thank you very much. That shows you how geeky we are here in this office. So that scene for me was annoying, because, you know, I liked the fact that the that they were sort of thinking about it in one sense before I saw the film. When I saw it, I was like, well, hang on, that didn't work. You shouldn't have added it in if it doesn't work. Thinking that this would be the final version of the film, and why add a shot in that you would actually still want to fix again. What did you think of that one, Mark?
Yeah, that one was, I think, just kind of meant to be over the top and funny. Something that people don't all the time realize about George and his attitude about Star Wars is that he encourages artists to go over the top with things and try things that are kind of maybe not what somebody who has utter respect and thinks that Star Wars is akin to you know, the secular religion of our times would do. So he, you know, I think he loves shtick, basically. But go ahead.
I gotta say, just because, you know, if George Lucas, who I think really is brilliant, he has done so much in terms of forwarding the ways we make movies. You know, I have nothing but respect for him as a as an innovator of filmmaking. But, and if he wants to keep tinkering with Star Wars, that's fine. But to me, Star Wars will always, always, always be the original versions. And I just wish they would release the original versions on DVD, you know, restore them. But to go back and change it, that would be like, this is beautiful Blu-ray restorations, these 4K restorations of the Godfather trilogy that came out. And Francis Ford Coppola even said, you know, they look better now than they ever did in release, because it's not a, you know, an answer print from a answer a neg, you know, it's not five generations down the line. This is right from the neg, yeah. Fully restored, digitally beautiful. And I wish they'd done that rather than, you know, they didn't go into Godfather and have Fredo live, you know?
well, is
that the equivalent of Han not shooting first?
Well, it's not just Han shooting first, but you change the character of Han Solo by having Greedo shoot first, and by having that jokey thing with Jabba the Hutt in there, and you change the tone of the films as a trilogy by making these alterations, by adding a musical sequence in where there was none before. And
I don't even like the replacement of the Death Star explosion. It's almost like it wasn't good. And, you know, that one could think, well, okay, we just modernized it. But it implies that it wasn't impressive before. The way you remember it wasn't really a big deal. Now it's a big deal because it's got a shockwave coming off of it.
Yeah, there's no doubt in my mind that was unnecessary, and I was in love with the first one. You know what I mean? It was like somebody took away somebody. So I had a picture of my, you know, wife on the. So he said, "No, I got a better picture." Well, no, I quite like the first one. Leave it alone. It's not your wife.
but to me, here's the thing: Star Wars is, among movies as a whole, but especially among visual effects, is one of the most important historical documents ever. Right, what they did was groundbreaking, was so influential to the next 30 years of movie making, and still is. And the fact that if you are a 10-year-old kid, you know, who is interested in film, living in America today, you cannot see the original Star Wars as it existed at the time, and not being able to understand how important it was to have that film in 1977 is horrible. Just as a simple fact of film history, to not have that out there is a travesty.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an interesting subject even in art, for example. You know, like when the artist finishes the piece, does that belong to the artist or does it belong to the public? And to a certain extent, I've heard artists say that they finish the piece and it goes out and then something will happen to it. And they'll say, well, that's it. It now has a life of its own. I've finished with it. It's got a life of its own. It's moved on. And certainly you'd have that argument from a Woody Allen or somebody that detests having the colorization done of old black and white films. I mean, this irreverence and like the shtick thing runs completely in the face of, you know, important historical document kind of perspective on the film. I mean, I do agree with you, but I just wonder whether, you know, would somebody accuse us of just taking this all a bit too seriously?
Well, it's not about... Go ahead, Mark.
George Lucas is a fantastically creative guy. He also is very prone to revising history. A lot of the stories about the stories of the film change if you track them over time. There's a whole book dedicated to the subject of, it's called The Secret History of Star Wars, about where the stories came from and how the story about the story kind of changed. So that is kind of just, you know, the whole thing of, are they twins? Are they brother and sister? Are they the same person? Are they lovers? You know, all these things were nebulous because they weren't actually clearly decided at the time as much as they are now in the current telling of the history. So the story is now, I always wanted it to be this. And it, you know, it's a story.
Right. And right? As I said, I have no problem with a filmmaker going back and futzing with his film. That's fine if he wants to do that, if he, you know, if he has it and can do that. But, you know, I'm much happier with the meddling that Spielberg did with E.T. Around the same time, where he replaced the guns with walkie-talkies, because, you know, the copy of E.T. I have on DVD, I can watch the original version, or I can show the new version. You know, it's my choice. But the fact that the original Star Wars is simply not available is what my problem is. Not, you know, not if he wants to go back and change what he's done, that's fine. But, you know, I have the I don't have a Laserdisc player anymore, but I have the Japanese Laserdisc set of the original Star Wars with the 5.1 surround sound, and I have my original VHS tape box collection. And that's, you know, I those are the only VHS tapes I have. It's because I don't ever want to not have the original Star Wars, and I wish it was just in a more, you know, current format, release it. You know, you'd make a lot of money, George. You'd make a lot more money.
Okay, well, let's go back to discussing visual effects just solely for a second then. And describe to me what you think are the effects that stand up best today. I mean, what do you actually feel like, you know, if you saw that in a film today, you just wouldn't feel the need to go and change it? Is there a lot? Is there not much? I mean, just with a modern perspective, full on, if this was, you know, being assessed by today's standards, how does it stand up? And start with you, Mark.
Well, let's discount things like matte lines and little problems and just talk about a shot I was going to name as my favorite, although it's just so simple, but it is a classic shot of Star Wars and of cinema, is the jump to light speed. And it's neither simple nor utterly complex. It just works, as does the... a lot of the stuff with the Falcon works really well. It's a cool ship, and the way it moves is pretty cool. You get the sense of Han Solo piloting it. It's kind of... And I think a lot of the animation just works stunningly well. You don't even need to know how difficult it was for them to do it. It just does. So that's one thing that I think works really well. Another one, oddly enough, are the holograms, which were done very crudely, but I think would be much less charming if you tried to do them through more modern methods. And that's talking both about the great stop motion work that Phil Tippett and John Berg did on The Chess Game, and also just the Princess Leia hologram and the way it was done by shooting it off a television. And
I think the Princess Leia hologram is superb in that we just buy it as being a hologram, even though it is just a badly done 2D thing. I mean, that's that, you know, you almost can't have a hologram today that doesn't have a video line going down through it, as to indicate
exactly.
I think I think the one where they're showing the planet coming able to be fired on, and it's kind of got that, you know, it's moving from, I think, left to right, and it's the targeting system for the Death Star. Again, is sort of crude, but it tells the story, and I think it really works effectively. I don't think the targeting on the Millennium Falcon for shooting from both of the two gun turrets works, because it just looks so hokey and so low-tech compared to what I would imagine it should be. I don't want them to change it. I'm just saying, you know, it doesn't hold up as well. But I think you're right. I'm surprising that those holograms do, because normally the thing that lets you down the most is any kind of graphics, any kinds of screens, any kind of representation of stuff, because it just, you know, graphics move so fast and change so quickly that what seemed to be very high sci-fi one moment seems to be like low-tech Windows media files the next. What about for you, David? What shots do you think just really hold up well today?
I think for the time, meaning, and I don't mean like, okay, for 1977, these were really impressive, but for the overall style of the film, I love, you bring up the graphics, I love the CG graphics that were used in the film, you know, the vector line art that was, you know, showing it off, because if it had been some kind of crude, you know, shaded polygons, it would have looked really dated. But the way that it was like a vector line, where it really looked like this is a schematic, you know, we're pulling this off of a blueprint, and these are almost like architectural drawings come to life. It looks still fantastic. Yeah, they, you know, the registration on the screen's a little off, but those graphics in and of themselves, I think, are perfect. Any place a matte painting appears in this movie is dead on perfect. And the other thing which I think really holds up and shouldn't change at all is the design, you know, the art direction of the film. I think from the costume design to the ship design to the set design is just perfect.
How is it that R2-D2 does not look hokey and stupid and Robbie the Robot? I mean, that should have never held up, right?
Yeah, he's a
testament to your
looking robot.
Point about art direction. It's just magnificent, isn't it? I mean, you know, by the final film, at no point I've ever looked at R2-D2 and gone, kind of a bit cringy. They've had to stick with it because he obviously can't justify changing him.
No, in close-ups too.
Yeah, totally. And the fact that his voice was done as beeps and that could be interpreted and stuff, again, doesn't sound like it's much, but it really, really held up. There's no sense that you listen to the soundtrack stuff done by Ben Burtt on this and feel like it's vastly inferior to the work he did on WALL-E. In fact, it's just all of the same genius. I think that sound design stuff is just, I mean, for me, knocks it out of the park and then some. You guys would have to agree, right?
The other thing about the design is we don't need to see more. So as much respect as I have for example, the Mos Eisley shot that I talked about, it seemed unnecessary to me. I understand that Mos Eisley was supposed to feel busier. That's fine. But, and you know, they had a lot of bad luck on the Tunisia shoot. So it's understandable that they didn't even get what they were going for there. But Star Wars had us all using our imaginations to create the other half of the Falcon when we only see half of it in the hangar. And to imagine what the other 99.99% of the Death Star is like and what those planets are all like. We all did that work, and that is the magic of this movie. And I think it's frankly diminished by trying to show more.
Yeah, it's like with Jaws when the shark didn't work. So you had to come up with ways around it, and it made it a much more frightening film. And in Star Wars, you have the characters are so iconic and so, you know, they're such archetypes that you can follow along so easily, even as a little kid, which is, I think, where a lot of the success comes into it. But, you know, you had your good guy all in white and you had your bad guy all in black, you know, this walking black monolith. You know, you couldn't do the super high detailed shots of the ship taking off or landing. And so you worried about the character. And, you know, you look at the prequels, episode 1, 2, and 3, and how many shots of landing gear, you know, settling down and all the little bits, you know, compressing and stuff do we have in those films? Because, you know, they're able to do it. And
okay, but I'm gonna bash my same drum that I was bashing a second ago, which is saying that one of the reasons that it's so easy to fill in the other 99% of that Death Star or the other, you know, 55% of whatever we don't see is the sound design, right? I mean, and I'm going to go as far as saying not just sound design, but the voice of James Earl Jones, the just everything about the sound of this film gave me what I needed for the rest of that to work. It hung together so well because of all the work that was done in the audio. I mean, the soundtrack, I mean, it's cliched now, but the John Williams soundtrack was just amazing at the time. It became like a pop hit.
The quality of the iconography of the sound is such that to this very day, every time I walk into a movie theater and sit down, and a 20th Century Fox fanfare starts up, that dun dun, you know, as it comes up. I still am expecting to see a ship fly over my head firing at the blockade runner to this very day, 30 years later, even though how many films has Fox done, you know, where I know it's not coming, but yet I still think it.
You know, Mike, you've made the two picks that turned the corner for the team that worked on this, according to most of the accounts. The flyover of the ship at the opening is apparently the one where everybody suddenly saw it in dailies and went, oh, we're not working on a B-movie. They actually saw what this thing was going for. And I think it was only when the sound went into it. I worked a little bit with Hal Barwood at LucasArts, and he was, you know, there are accounts of him and Matthew Robbins, director friends of George's from film school, hanging around and kind of laughing at this movie when it was in its early stages, when you still had Daniel Prowse talking through the mask and R2-D2's falling over at the end of each shot. And, you know, they used every frame they could of R2. Apparently he falls over the very next frame on pretty much every shot they used. And the sound was exactly what turned the corner from it being an object of derision to what it is.
I mean, let's talk about the lightsaber fight, because we're now, you know, the point where lightsaber, you know, you do it on After Effects and stuff. But I remember...
on YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. But I remember looking at that the second or third time I saw the film to really try and understand what they were doing. And it just dawning on me that there were just seemed to be flash frames in there and odd things that were going on. And it was like, wait a second, that somebody's breaking the rules and it just completely works. And I was just dumbfounded at how an editor was allowed to just cut in a frame of white, it seemed like. I don't know if it was a frame of white, but it felt like it as a kid. And I was just looking at it like, well, huh? And yet I completely appreciate, I mean, today I understand exactly what they were doing, but then it was just like, because that fight sequence, if you take out those extra flashes and those extra zings and take away the sound, its sword mastery is not anywhere near what we'd expect it to be as iconic as it is. Wouldn't you agree, David?
Oh, absolutely. It's. I think anyone who's worked on a major film, or even a non-major film, who's seen dailies, you know, they look really, really lame. you know, they're. The sound is off, the color is off, everything like that, and you know, it's if you're looking at something being edited together, with, you know, delivering, let's face it, some pretty hokey lines, and every, you know, fifth or sixth shot, a black card comes up that says effect missing or what have you, and you don't have all that sound going on, it's going to be a pretty lame film. But you add it all together, and there's so much iconography. I mean, you could to this day, you could have a pure black screen, and you could hear Darth Vader breathing, and you know exactly, you know, your mind goes exactly to where it is. You could hear the sound of a lightsaber opening up, and you know exactly what it means. And so many of the effects that are in this film are, you know, they're now presets in After Effects, you know, to have the text crawl or to do a lightsaber
right.
effect.
I think we've had enough After Effects bashing, gentlemen. I'm calling a moratorium.
I'm not bashing it, but like you go back to the U.S. election last year, where CNN had the little hologram things that they did, and they made it a blue transparent with scan lines in it. To have these, the holograms that were down. All it was an, ring of HD cameras. They could have made it look exactly like the person who was sitting in the studio with Wolf Blitzer, but they had to make it look like Star Wars, because when you think hologram, that's what you think of. The amount of iconography and the amount of people, just go down the list of people who worked on this film, who came out of this film: Ken Ralston, Dennis Muren, Phil Tippett, Joe Johnston, John Dykstra, ad infinitum. You can just keep Ben Burtt, keep naming him, and every one of them is now a legend in our field. And they all started on this film. And, that's just what's so amazing to me.
Yeah, I totally agree. So look, in researching this project, and certainly we did quite a lot of research because it was just fun. I mean, I think you said, David, it was just one of the most fun things we've had a chance to research. Was there anything that you guys found when sort of poking around that you didn't know? Because, I mean, we've been in the industry for years. We've read, seen, spoken to, lived, in your cases, worked at Lucasfilm. There are things that you just yourselves didn't know until you started preparing for today's show. Was there anything for you, David?
My favorite story was they're talking about building, and this is came out of a Cinefex article, they're talking about building the Death Star tiles, where they had they would kitbash, and they had these kind of mass produced tiles that they'd fit together. And they were out there with Scotch-Brite tape, cutting them with scissors into 1/8 of an inch by 1/8 of an inch squares and applying them to this model, for hours and hours and hours out in the 103 degree temperatures of Van Nuys, in the middle of summer in LA. No fun to be out in a parking lot. And then George Lucas sent his wife, Marcia, down to the set to check it out. And she was like, yeah, the windows look too big. And they had to go and take all the tape off and reapply it. And it's funny because all the people were in the article were talking about how they hated it. They hated it, and they'd find any excuse to go off and do something else and take as long as possible doing that other thing so they didn't have to go out to the parking lot. And I was thinking about that, and then these days we'd have like a procedural window control, So the amount of just brute force work that, you go back and you read about how they made this. And, visual effects today has kind of turned into an office job where you show up, you sit in a air-conditioned cubicle, and you punch into a keyboard and a mouse, and you make things happen. And then you go to lunch, and then you come back, and you do the same thing. And it really is, I hate to break it to people, no different than being an accountant in terms of your working environment. And just the fun these guys had figuring out how to do stuff and playing with it, it made me really appreciate the field I'm in.
What about you, Mark? Anything you discovered while researching?
Just to add to that for a second, the same day as we were originally going to record this show, a Vimeo popped up of some old Super 8 footage of everybody actually working on Star Wars in Van Nuys in 75, 76, 77. And it's pretty amazing. I guess I will say we'll put a link in the show notes. Can we do that?
You can say put a link on the website, yeah.
Yeah, okay. The thing that I knew going into this was that compositing was very crude leading up to this film and including in this film, but I didn't have such a clear idea of exactly how and why. The optical printer, which is still on the premises of ILM behind glass, that was used for Star Wars, had a note on it having last been used on the Ten Commandments, and that was literally like it was just gathering dust. It was the only VistaVision optical printer that they could find, and that technology, blue screen technology, was known pretty much not to work in movies. It's not that they chose to use it the way we would choose to use it now. It really was known to deliver pretty bad results, as was Dolby sound in the couple of films that had used it. So they were actually using tech that was known to be broken or compromised and avoided. The reason that Kubrick did all those shots in 2001 in camera was exactly that. He didn't want to compromise it with comping and optical comping. And what I didn't know was that they also leveraged some IP, if you want to call it that, photochemical IP by Petros Vlahos, who is another person who would go on to win, I think, a technical Oscar. And he's known as Pete Vlahos. But so they actually advanced just how you pulled a blue screen in this and kind of brought it back from the dead.
Yeah, that is true. I didn't know that. I mean, well, at least if I did, I certainly didn't fully appreciate it, because I guess, trying to think about it, a lot of the stuff around that time was like rear projection, wasn't it? I mean, if you had a car and you're doing shots out the window, you'd sort of rear project it because the blue screen would look so hokey.
Yeah, and it was chroma keying. News Weathermen, I think, was about where chroma key was at that point.
I mean,
that's
a lot of...
That's true, yeah, chroma key.
There were a lot of little facts that I came across that I was kind of surprised about. I mean, the fact that both Al Pacino and Robert De Niro turned down the role of Han Solo. I don't know if that's true, but apparently it is. And I also didn't know that that Luke Skywalker's aunt had all her dialogue dubbed over. But I did not really, I guess, appreciate some of the stuff until you get really deep into it on the technical stuff that makes the difference for what they couldn't pull off. And I think more than anything, I sort of imagined, even though I sort of knew about it, I sort of imagined that the motion control stuff came first. And as you said, the blue screen stuff came first and they used it in Star Wars. But as you sort of, I think you touched on there, it was really much more the case of sort of inventing it to make it happen, which makes it all the more frightening when you just think about taking on a project. Because I don't think today I just could possibly imagine having the nerve to do it. It'd be like, you know, like we want to create all these incredible environments and all this incredible stuff. And these guys, to their credit, just started a project that had no clear finish line or even path to the finish line. It was like, we want you to set off on this epic run and we're not going to tell you which way to go or which is the way to go. And we're not even going to tell you if you're going to be able to make it. And they did. And they almost didn't.
They really came close to not making it. And August 1st, 1976, they had finaled one shot. And the thing about the blue screen usage also is that they intended to do a lot more stuff, front projection, actually not rear projection, in England. And ILM just didn't deliver the shot. So they had to use blue screen a lot more than was even intended for that reason. So, you know, and I mean, there's a story of George Lucas going to the hospital with what he thought was a heart attack after he drove away from ILM, having arrived back from England to see how things were going. It's a story that he told when ILM turned 30 a few years ago. So it obviously stuck with him.
One of the things that Dykstra actually wound up doing is he had George come down to ILM, you know, to the warehouse and spend a day to see how they were doing stuff. And suddenly George had a lot less comments to make about a shot because he realized that, you know, if he was making one little change after they were showing him a finished shot, it was not a simple fix. They had to start over from scratch you know, he suddenly gave him a lot more leeway in terms of how they're working, because he understood what they were up against. So, you know, we owe so much to these guys. It's not even, you know, quantifiable in our humble little podcast. You know, I've had the great joy of meeting a lot of these guys over the course of my career and working with a few of them or just hanging out socially. Dennis Mirren was on my tug of war team a few years back, but it's you know, I just want everyone who's listening to these podcasts who their only exposure to visual effects is Studio Max and Maya and Houdini to really go back and think about, like, how hard it is to create a shot of a four spaceships moving through space independently by not moving the ships, but by moving a camera along them.
I mean, literally, yeah. Just pick a scene from the battle sequence of Star Wars and say, I want to do this without using computer graphics. I'm going to do this without using, you know, digital compositing. I mean, it's inconceivably hard.
Yeah. It's insane. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, we're going to get a motion-controlled camera, and in order to program it, you have to do it by listening to it. And, you know exactly how it sounds because you built the thing yourself. It's just amazing, and I really encourage everyone whose only exposure to visual effects is computer graphics to really go back and understand where your livelihood is coming from.
Don't you also feel that there is something to be said for if you had such a limited, because I mean iteratively, when I'm on a shot, I will render that shot many, many times. I'll iteratively just try and improve it. But these guys used to have to sit around and really think it through before they did a pass because the iterative cycle was days, as you said earlier, right? I think there was something to be said for having a very, very talented group of people that would sit around and just discuss to death how something was going to be done rather than just plow in and just hit render and hit render and hit render and sort of try and get there. I mean, I just feel like there was a discipline that if you were going to have to do an entire optical composite, you would really think about that sucker to death before you even sort of attempted to commit this to the shot, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, we just don't do that today. We just can't. I mean, we don't have the schedule, we don't have the time, we don't have the whatever.
Yeah.
We just don't.
Technology has made us into very lazy filmmakers who take a lot for granted. You know, it's like, okay, a boom mic fell into the shot. No deal, we'll fix it in post. You know, back then, everyone had to do their job and be on their A game all the time. And, yeah, it's really amazing to me to look back at this film and think about how they had to do it. It's just amazing.
So I'm going to finish now with the thing that I normally start with, which I deliberately held off, which is just to say, I mean, point blank, leaving all the effects aside for a second, and I'll start with you, Mark. Did you just love this film? I mean, just in terms of the film, the story, did it just point blank? We always start with that. Normally, what do you think of the film, the plot, etc.? Am I just imagining that it was as good as it was?
No, I think it's a work of genius. I think it is genius in the sense of distilling down to such a really simple, in many ways, concept, playing on universal themes and just resounding to an extent to where really it is incredible how the world of Star Wars is used interchangeably with, you know, the Bible, any work of literature you could name, pretty much any other part of our culture. I can't think of any that truly outweigh Star Wars in our current consciousness. It's kind of staggering to think how big a presence it plays and how recent a phenomenon that is. And a lot of effects nerds that I know prefer Empire Strikes Back as a film full of complexity and this great character that we all love and more polished effects work and visiting more elaborate planets and scenes. But Star Wars is the one that had the genius and the magic and that lit the fuse for all of it and a whole lot more. So, yeah, I think it's I have never gotten tired of it. I just think it's one of those things. I'm going to start gushing here, so I'm going to shut up now.
And David, with your writer's hat on, just looking at it in terms of a piece of fictional writing?
It's great. It's you know, it's straight out of Carl Jung and Joseph Campbell, and it appeals to everyone across all ages, across both genders, across cult. You know, you can go to China and find people who are fans of the film. You can go to Russia. You can go to Uganda. You could go to, I'm sure there's penguins who are really big Star Wars fans and walk around dressed like Ewoks. But you know, it's has such universal appeal. Is it the best movie ever made? No, but it is my favorite movie ever made. And to me personally, it is the most important movie ever made because it made me be the person I am today. From age 7 onwards, this has been the most important movie in my life.
Well, I think there's no better way to finish that up than on that note. We're going to do another episode, as we say, in a couple of weeks' time, where we're going to look at almost like the the Star Wars universe, because we try to limit ourselves very much to the 1977 film in this one. There is so much to discuss in terms of the other films that followed it, and of course the games, the rides, the computer, you know, alternate universes, and then the use of that iconography and the use of that stuff into just about every other form of popular culture. But that's coming up in a future episode. Mark, do you want to thank our team behind the scenes here at the VFX Show?
Yeah, we'll say thank you to our producer, Kristen Martin, and to Lori Apthorpe and Todd Schulten for contributing research and background information and maintaining the website. Thanks a lot, you guys.
And where can people find you, Mark, if they want to pester you, follow you, or generally keep track of you?
You know, Twitter is a reliable way to hear from me, and that is Flowseeker at Twitter.
And what about you, David?
Same with me. I'm Twitter / David Skripinis, and Facebook / David Skripinis. And anyone who's looking to meet up with me, I will be at Comic-Con this year, so don't be afraid to come up if you can find me and say hello.
And, of course, I'm over at fxguide.com and fxphd.com. And for those of you that didn't enjoy Star Wars, I have but simply to quote the words of the immortal Darth Vader, "I find your lack of faith disturbing." Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you.